This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
If you think the future looks troubled, a personal bunker is not the answer. We will need each other and resilient communities. Dr. Rob Hopkins is a world leader in that quest. He is a co-founder of the Transition Town Movement, the Transition Network, and author of essential books like The Transition Handbook, From Oil Dependency to Local Resilience, and The Transition Companion, Making Your Community More Resilient in Uncertain Times. We are going to talk about Rob's new venture and his shorthand guide to going forward. Rob Hopkins, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thank you.
I've been wanting to talk to you for some time, and I noticed looking at your blog on March 13th, 2017, you announced that while still helping the transition movement, you would take some time off to explore a new topic. How has that worked out for you and for the Transition Town movement?
Well, it's sort of still work in progress, and I still do a lot with transition. I still do a lot of traveling and speaking and stuff. But I've been doing some research around imagination, and I read a piece of research a few years ago that was a researcher in the U.S. who gathered together something called the Torrance Test for Creative Thinking over the last sort of 60, 70 years in the U.S. And her conclusion was that IQ and imagination rose together until 1990, and then they parted company, and IQ kept rising and imagination started to decline. And when she published it, it was on the front page of Newsweek. It was a really big story. What does this mean for economic growth and for Silicon Valley and for Hollywood? I never heard anybody in the climate change, social justice movements who even mentioned it. And it struck me as a really interesting thing, you know, that what we're trying to do in transition and in many other similar movements is to help people imagine a different future, you know, reimagine what's in front of us in a different way. And maybe if actually there's a problem with our collective imagination, that's something we need to give some thought to and work out some strategies for how to manage that.
And are you planning that to be a book? Is that the thought?
Yeah, that's the plan at the moment. It's going quite slowly, but that is the plan, yeah.
All right. Well, here's what I propose. I'd like to start with a dialogue with a bit of chat on imagination and then work back to community resilience and how to get there. Does that sound all right?
Perfect. That sounds great, yeah.
Great. So I looked at Wikipedia, which isn't always that authoritative, but it has this definition for the word imagination. It says that imagination, the ability to form images, ideas, and sensations in the mind without any immediate input of the senses, such as seeing or hearing. And if you could let me explain for a minute, I think there's a possible dangerous side to that. And that's because, as you know, Rob, in the Dark Ages, people valued imagination more than their senses, and we got witches and other imaginary beings. And then Francis Bacon comes along and conceives of science in order to bring humans back to their senses to deal with things as they are, measurable, hard, and real, and it's sort of a guide against the perils of imagination. How do you see that relationship between imagination that we should cultivate and science?
Yeah, I mean, the definition that I like is a woman called Maxine Green, who said that imagination is the ability to look at things as if they could be otherwise. And actually, that's really been the foundation of most great science. You know, Albert Einstein went out on his bicycle and cycled about and daydreamed and imagined himself as an atom flying through the universe. I don't see that there's any, that it's, you know, either we have imagination or we have science. You know, most of the best science really has its roots in the imagination and then in a way that's kind of tested rigorously and so on. But, you know, I think for me, the problem at the moment is that we seem to have put all of our eggs into the scientific basket, I suppose. And we have less and less opportunities in our lives, I think, in 2018. To allow our imaginations to really flourish. You know, our education system has become much more about learning stuff, passing exams, being tested from the age of four, much less room for the arts and for play and for being imaginative. Our workspace is often much more, you know, ticking boxes and so on and so on. And then universities, there seems to be less space for it. The time when we would wander around and daydream and allow ideas to come to us, we seem to be filling up with hours and hours spent on smartphones and on Facebook and so on. You know, so for me, it's not that we need imagination exclusively, because if we just folk cultivated purely the imagination, we'd all just wander around and not achieve very much. But if we are trying to figure out a way forward in the times we are in now, with the challenges that we face, then having a really strong, healthy imagination, the ability to ask what if, which lies at the heart of science, I think is also something that needs to really lie at the heart of our activism.
And what about technology? Is that anti-imaginary?
Certainly not by definition. You know, there's lots of technology that can really help and facilitate that. But I think we seem to increasingly be seeing forms of technology which are about capturing our attention and holding our attention and giving us very little in return. And these sort of dopamine-driven apps and tools that are, I think, very harmful to the imagination. One of the guys I spoke to, a neuroscientist, he said, I think that our imagination, the degree to which our imaginative is, runs opposite to the amount of time that we spend on our smartphones. There is a kind of bit of a perfect storm of things that are coming together that are really not helping the imagination, in terms of we spend a lot less time out of doors, we spend a lot more time in front of screens, you know, 60% of our time awake, we sleep less because of these devices. And I think when we start to look at all these things together, I think our imaginations are really quite challenged, because in order to have a healthy imagination, we need to have spaces where we come together with other people to be imaginative, and we know people spend less and less time engaging with each other. We need to be rested. We need to have we need to have a space where we can do that, and we have less and less time in our lives to just look out the window, dream, talk with other people. How could it be? And I think that's a real danger.
You know, what you've just said with the neuroscience, I wonder, is there a particular part of the brain where imagination takes place, and could it wither away as we watch our prepared media, movies and games and television?
Yeah, I mean, that's been one of the things that's been most interesting to me, is there's a small part in the brain called the hippocampus, which people always associated mainly with memory, as it being the center of the memory. And although, you know, there's, I suppose when I was a kid, you know, you'd sometimes see those sort of china heads, you know, with the different parts of the brain being put down to different things. That idea that each aspect of us is belongs to a different part of the brain is something that they're really moving away from now, neuroscientists, and saying, actually, it's about networks and different networks that fire at different times when we're doing different things. And there are particular networks that are connected to the imagination, but the hippocampus is really central to all of those. So it's the place where our memory exists, but it's also where we imagine the future. And the thing with the hippocampus is that it is uniquely vulnerable to cortisol. So when people are traumatized, when people are stressed, when people are very frightened, neuroscientists can see on scans that the hippocampus visibly shrinks. When children are brought up in environments that are traumatic and unstimulating and stressful, they have visibly smaller hippocampi than people who don't have that. So I think that there's something about when we live in a world which is constantly pumping out dystopian visions of the future, fearful messages, when we are in a high state of anxiety, we can't even put our phone down without feeling anxious that we might miss something, then I think we're at a time when, you know, our hippocampi are very vulnerable and very fragile. So for me, there's that question about, well, how do we create those spaces where we can come together and actually revalue the imagination, I suppose, create the optimal conditions for our hippocampus to flourish.
I can picture the activist campaign, Protect the Endangered Hippocampi.
Not the endangered hippopotamus.
Not quite.
Hippocampus, yeah.
Now, look, if we assume that indigenous people continue to cultivate imagination, have you or will you consult with those cultures in your exploration?
I have been talked to some interesting movements in India who are doing very interesting work around alternative approaches to education. And I'm soon talking to a guy in Hawaii who's one of the indigenous people in Hawaii about the way that they use visioning and imagination to tell a story and to really bring the future of that island to life. And I recently interviewed a woman who does a lot of work with indigenous people in South America and looking at what they bring to that. So, yeah, that is a part of the exploration.
Now, Britain's Conservative Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher adopted a slogan from Herbert Spencer that said, "There is no alternative to the market-based system of capitalism." Rob Hopkins, what is your response?
There's always an alternative. It was one of the many ludicrous things that Margaret Thatcher said over the years. And the idea that there's no alternative is a perfect way to shut down the imagination in any setting. If you say, no, that's it, there's no alternative. You know, of course there's an alternative. And part of the problem, I think, is that a lot of us swallowed that. And that actually what we see now as being this kind of terror of these sort of dystopian visions of the future, the degree to which we struggle to imagine a future which is fair, sustainable, a society that is able to live within its limits. Part of that is because we have been sold this idea that there is no alternative to neoliberal capitalism in the way that we currently see it. And I think part of our work, part of what we try and do in transition is to say, of course there is. In fact, actually, you know, if somebody says to me, well, if there is an alternative, what would it be like? Describe it to me. You know, I always sort of piece something together out of things that already exist. You know, I can say, well, I would wake up in the morning in a beautiful apartment block built out of straw bales with local straw, local timber, 100% composting toilets. I'd walk out through the gardens, through streets with not very many cars in and, you know, really thriving local businesses. And I'd drop my kids off at a school which had changed how it taught, and there was much less testing, and the school was a real example of all of these kind of things. And, you know, I can paint that picture for ages, but when I'm doing that, it's not some flight of fancy of my imagination. It's really piecing together things I've already seen. I've stayed in an apartment block like that in Geneva. There are schools like that in Finland. You know, all of this stuff already exists in different places. So actually, when somebody says there's no alternative, it really speaks to their chronic lack of the imagination. The danger when someone like Thatcher says is that it kind of becomes infectious and people buy into it.
Your journey got me wondering, is there a public imagination, or is imagination always a private and individual experience?
I think there's both. I think that we do have a kind of a shared imagination and stories that we tell each other and stories that we believe and that we buy into collectively. Yeah, and I guess that was what that research I mentioned at the beginning was looking at, was there was a big enough data set that she was saying, well, actually, this looks like it's reflective of the collective imagination. Clearly, we all have our own individual imaginations, and there are things that we can do to make ourselves as imaginative as possible. But at the same time, I think, you know, that when the imagination really sparks into life for me, and it's something that I've seen again and again with transition projects in many different places, is when people come together. And the thing that I've been writing about recently is about this idea of what if, you know, making these what if spaces where people can come together with other people and say, what if we had what if we had our own money here, or we had our own bank, or what if we did this in a different way, and then went off and did it? You know, we've been doing transition now for 11 or 12 years, and we now think of it as being a movement of communities who are reimagining and rebuilding the world, and you have to do both of those things together. I was in Liège in Belgium a couple of weeks ago, where they had I went there 4 years ago, where their transition group had just started, and I went to an event that was all framed around a what-if question. And the question was, what if, in a generation's time, the majority of food eaten in this city came from this city, or the land around this city, the land immediately around this city? And they invited together farmers and scientists and chefs and shop owners and everybody with an interest in food, and just opened a space with that as a what-if question. And then I went back after 4 years, and they've started 14 cooperatives. They've raised €5 million from local people. The municipality, the local government, are completely behind it and making a load of their land available to the whole thing. I met the mayor of the city, who said, 8 years ago we wanted to be a smart city, now we want to be a transition city. You know, and when I talked to them and said, well, how did you get here? How did you you know, in 4 years, how did you make all this stuff happen? And he said, well, because we had a really strong what if question. And we held that space. We didn't say we've got it all worked out. They just held a space that invited people's imagination in. And then when they did that, all kinds of things were then able to happen.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Rob Hopkins. He's the author of many books on creating communities resilient to problems of the present and the expected shocks as a troubled future unfolds, or perhaps as a better future unfolds. Is that a fair assessment, Rob?
Yeah. I'm very interested in the future, and I refuse to kind of buy into that idea that the future is inevitably going to be rubbish. And I think there's every possibility that we could still create a future that's really quite amazing, but it needs us to come together and get on with it, really.
The first transition town was famously in Totnes, England. We broadcast in several countries, though, and more than half of Radio EcoShock listeners are in the United States. Can I ask how far the transition town movement has penetrated into America?
Yes. So it says there's 163. I just looked up. There's 163 transition initiatives in the U.S., and you can find them on transitionus.org. Transition US, which exists as what we call a national hub, so it's like the national organization which sort of supports and trains and tries to connect together the different transition groups across the US. So it's something like that, yeah, about 170. I know they had a national conference earlier this year, and there seems to be a lot of activity happening in lots of places.
I do get feedback from listeners who are involved in it or want to be. But I do worry that my own program and even the science presented by Radio EcoShock can become trapped in a bubble of English speakers in Western-style culture. So I'm curious how transition is received in other parts of the world. I mean, is the movement still valid, say, in heavily populated areas of China or Indonesia?
Yeah. So when we started transition, we were really inspired by something that was called contraction and convergence, which was a climate model at the time, which said at the moment the global north consumes about 80% more than it should. It needs to bring its carbon footprint down by about 70-80% to a level where the global south can then meet them, and then that's the kind of point at which things can continue, you know? So our kind of founding inquiry really was, what does it look like if we see that move as a move forward? Because if in the global north we see that as a move away from something, as a move towards less, as kind of going backwards somehow, then it's not going to happen. If we don't have the stories about how remarkable, how extraordinary, how fascinating that world could be with its amazing flavors and tastes and events and all the stuff that could happen there, then we're just simply not going to do it. So for us, it felt really important that we were basically designing a sort of a detox program for the affluent West, if you like. We weren't designing a model that was going to work in China or Africa or somewhere like that. What's been really fascinating has been to see transition being picked up by people in the global South and taking it and making it their own and changing it and adapting it. There's a lot of transition happening in Brazil, in Colombia, in favelas, in Sao Paulo, in Brazil. A lot happening in sort of Southeast Asia, Korea, South Korea, starting in China, bits of China, little parts of Africa. And in South America, it often kind of sits alongside the kind of Buen Vivir, Via Campesina kind of movements. And people pick it up as a tool and adapt it and make it their own. And that's really fascinating to see for me, because that really wasn't the original intent of the model, I suppose.
But that is really exciting. And you've written a new guide. It's called 7 Steps to Creating a Sustainability Transition Movement in Your Community. Where will that appear? How can my listeners find that?
Well, actually, those come from something that we did that's called the Essential Guide to Doing Transition, which is a free guide that you can find at transitionnetwork.org. It's there as a resource for people to download. It's a kind of a full-color guide to getting transition started where you are. And there's two there. There's that one, and then there's also another one that we did for COP21 when that took place in Paris, December 2015, that was called 21 Stories of Transition, where we went out to the transition movement and said, we're off to Paris, we're going to go and fly the transition flag at the COP21 negotiations, which stories should we take? And we were sent in hundreds of stories by transition groups from around the world, and we condensed those down into 21 and produced this really good little book that tells all of those stories. So if people want a crash course in what transition is, and then some tools for how to get started, have a look at transitionnetwork.org and you'll find them all there.
On the subject of climate change, I've just finished a series of interviews with top scientists, and they have dire news about much earlier than expected signs of severe climate change, things like the ocean currents slowing down and a long list. How seriously do you see the climate challenge, Rob?
It's the thing that keeps me awake at night, really. I mean, it's, I suppose, one of the main reasons why I've given the last 12 years of my life and before to all of this has really been because of the science those guys are talking about. I have children and maybe grandchildren aren't too far away in my life, and that's really what motivates me, absolutely. I think the bit that where I tend to focus my energy is on that, you know, if we were to stay below 1.5 degrees, what would that take? And what would it look like? And Kevin Anderson, who's one of the most brilliant sort of interpreters of climate science, I think, had a conference recently that was called the Radical Emissions Conference that was about what would that be like, actually? If we were able to stay below 1.5 degrees, what would that mean for transport, for food, for energy, for employment, you know? And there's people, all of that stuff, you know, we could do that. We could still do that. You know, it's not that we will avoid climate change, because climate change has already started, but we could certainly avoid it spiraling completely out of control. But in order to do that, we have to be able to imagine what it would be like to wake up in that world and how extraordinary it could be and what possibilities it would offer, and then tell that story. And so that people are thinking, well, why would we want to go there when we could go there? That could just be fantastic. So it's that bit about imagination and story that really fascinates me. I've really noticed over the last few years how my role of going out and talking about transition has increasingly become kind of being a storyteller. You know, I gather stories from one place, I take them to another place, and it's really a movement of stories that we always say to people. You can start a transition initiative wherever you are. It doesn't cost you anything. You don't have to pay an annual membership. All the resources are there for you for free. The only condition is that you share your stories. And so whether it's people starting a food garden in a street in Brussels, or the guys in Sarasota doing food gleaning projects, or, you know, big local currency community energy projects, those are the stories that people need to hear, because they don't hear that stuff anywhere else. And if the imagination needs anything, it needs a kind of a big palette of ideas and possibilities and stories to draw from. That's really what feeds it and where it all comes from, you know.
Do you think we can retool this civilization, sort of remake it from the inside while it's still standing? Or do we need a collapse before something new can really happen?
Well, my sense about collapse is, you know, and I've been around a lot of people for a long time who've been motivated by collapse, is, you know, from what I was talking about before about the hippocampus and the idea that the imagination shrinks and contracts in a fearful, when it's fearful, when it's in anxiety, is that if we're going to have a collapse, then the thing that will make us most effective during that time will be the health of our imagination, our ability to imagine our way through that and be creative and flexible and adaptable. And if we're going to avoid a collapse, it'll be because we're at our most imaginative. And so for me, whichever way we look at it, being as imaginative as possible is really important. And actually, if we try to motivate people to get involved by warning of an imminent collapse, I think we don't engage very many people. It doesn't really work. It's not a very skillful way to really inspire people to get involved in something. And I've seen it with a lot of people I know who, you know, there are a handful of people who you can talk to about collapse and who are able to somehow transmute that into being very driven and motivated and getting on with stuff. But most people don't respond in that way. What works much better, in my experience, is painting a picture of what we could create from this point going forward.
It's interesting you say that, because I've talked to psychologists, including from Britain, who have said the same thing, that humans are not motivated by fear towards real change. There's another book out called The Transition Starts Here, Now, and Together. I haven't seen it. What can you tell us about that?
So this is a book which a guy called Lionel Astruc, a French writer, came to Totnes, where I live, and interviewed me every day for a week, and then went away and wrote this book. So it's kind of my words, but kind of arranged by him. And it's a particular kind of a format that is very popular in France, this sort of interview-based book. So it'll be really interesting to see if anybody reads it in the US, or, you know, how it goes. I think it has a really nice flow to it. It's kind of me talking about me, I suppose, a bit, and where the transition idea came from, and, you know, how it grew, how it evolved, what it looked like in Totnes. So it's quite sort of autobiographical, quite conversational. And in France, people have really, really enjoyed it. It came out of a film that was called Tomorrow, or in France was called Demain, which came out in late 2015, which was a film about, you know, the world we could create now, the tomorrow that we could create, which I appear in, and which was incredible phenomena in France. It won Best Documentary in the French Oscars. It was millions and millions of people saw it. It ran in mainstream cinemas for months and months. So this is a series of books that they've done with some of the key people in the film going into it in more depth and kind of telling their story.
I have been hoping to talk with you for a long time, and now here we are, and I still feel like I'm missing something important. Would you like to just take over this microphone as we wrap up and tell our listeners anything else that's on your mind these days?
I guess it feels to me like, you know, what we've done in transition for the last 12 years has been an experiment, really. And it's an experiment that many of your listeners will have been part of and contributed to and seen happening around where they live. And I love being part of something that has that permission to play and that permission to experiment. It feels very rewarding now to look and see some of the stuff that's happening in transition groups where they're starting to make a real difference and build new businesses, build new infrastructure. And that's the stuff that gets me out of bed, you know. It's like the story I mentioned about Liège or all the other places that you go to where people are saying, this is the thing that we want to do. This is our future. This is our story for the world that we want our grandchildren to see. And we've started it, and it's going really well. And I feel like I know more people than I ever knew before. And I feel part of something historic that's moving, something that's changing. You know, I'm with other people. We're working together. We trust each other. There's something so magical about that. I just love it. Every time I see it or experience it, I kind of see the future, the hope for the future that we're all trying to create.
We've been hearing from the social activist famous among millions of people wanting resilient ways of living. Rob Hopkins is the author of two key books, The Transition Handbook, From Oil Dependency to Local Resilience, and The Transition Companion, Making Your Community More Resilient in Uncertain Times. He is now offering a 7-step guide toward community building, and soon we hope a book that will literally stimulate our imagination. You can find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Rob Hopkins, thank you so much for being with us on Radio EcoShock, and I hope we can talk again.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me on. Cheers.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Check into our website at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for listening this week and caring about our world.